Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
Coming up on his show today, Matt Glantz, a high-stakes poker pro, a mixed games expert. A guy who has got himself $4 million or more in tournament winnings in the last decade or so, and is just back from the PCA with some pretty good results down there as well, and also recently wrote a blog piece about responsibility in poker, about how poker players need to be more responsible to give our game a better image. It's a topic that we have talked about many times before on this show. And so Matt Glantz will join us a little bit later. Hello, I am Paul Harrah, sitting at the feature table of the Harrah's St. Louis World Series of Poker Room, where the jackpot is over $33,000 and the cash games and tournaments are surrounding me. Meanwhile, my partner Dennis Phillips is himself back from the Bahamas, where he spent about 10 days at the PCA, back at his home in Las Vegas now. Hi, Dennis, how are you?
I'm doing great, trying to recover. The Bahamas is fun. And 10 days down there and all, but I'm kind of glad to be back and sleeping in a comfortable and a normal bed.
Now, last time we talked to you, you were playing in a couple of tournaments. You had played in the main event, and I think you played in at least one other event. Tell us about the results, and also, did you get into any cash games down there?
Played in a couple of other tournaments. Results were nothing to talk about. I was 0 for 3 on the tournaments. Didn't cash in any of them. A lot of good competition. A lot of good players down there. Played in the cash games. Cash games were fun.
Yeah,
Paul, you should come down and play in the cash games.
You know, you've told me this before, because I'm not really as much of a tournament player as you are. I love the cash games, and you keep telling me you should come down there and just play nothing but cash games. Were there games of every level?
There were. They had this year a little bit different. They had a high-limit room, basically, for the cash game, which only had, I think, four tables in it. But in there, they ran games, you know, from 100, 200, that type of thing, some mixed games. You walk in there, and you see a Jean Robert, you see Elie Lazare, you see our guest coming in today. Matt was playing in some of those nosebleed-type games and having it. People that run the floor at the Venetian, Terry, was down there running it and doing an excellent job. But then in the main room, they had cash games going all the time. The nice thing about down there at the PCA is, well, number one, 18-year-olds can play down there.
Mm.
So there's a wide variety of people who are used to playing online and do not play very often in live games, and they're showing up down there trying to bring their online skills to the live table. Now, this is not a knock for online. Don't get me wrong whatsoever. But when a guy forgets to protect his cards hand after hand, he's probably not used to playing live.
He's not using a card protector or putting a chip on top, at least, or covering it with his hand.
There you go. Absolutely. So, you know, a little bit of a tell there and such.
Yep.
Plus, some of the people down there were relaxing considerably. And they're always fun to play with people that are being politically correct here, are very relaxed at the table.
I'm guessing we're talking about alcohol use here.
one of the things. You're in the Bahamas. It's in the middle of January. You're enjoying it. You're with friends. You're sitting at a poker table. There were several people that were in partaking of liquid refreshments quite frequently.
I always like to see that at the table.
Yeah, and then there were some of them, of course. There were a group of very young European players that were down there, and they were having fun. And occasionally they would sit at your table with more money than common sense at the time and things like that. I got involved in a couple of hands with the people. And I sat down one day at a 5-10 table, not that big of a deal. All of us had 1,000, 2,000 in front of us, somewhere in that range. Was there for only about 15 minutes and woke up to pocket aces. Was under the gun. So I was just a 5-10 table. I made it 45, went around to another gentleman who made it 145, after two callers on my 45, by the way, came back to me, so I bumped it to 410. The two other people that had called my 45 and just mucked their cards instantly, and the guy looked at me and talked for a minute and says, well, no poker player can lay this down, and he shoved. I beat him into the pot, of course. He turned over an ace of diamonds and a king of hearts. And I agreed with him wholeheartedly. I said, yeah, you just can't lay that down. That's not a problem.
Now, please don't tell me this is going to end up as a bad beat story with like a queen jack 10 flop or something.
No. It did flop two hearts. I had to worry for a second one. But, he was drawn dead by the river. So it wasn't any real problem there. And felt that the guy took the cash from him, which was fine. And he's over there talking about it and how bad a luck it is and all this other stuff and everything. We were playing nine-handed, and I will guarantee there were eight people sitting at the table going, please rebuy, please rebuy, please rebuy.
Now, let's talk about this play for just a second, because you and I have had many discussions over the years about ace-king, a hand that I think gets overplayed tremendously. You and I still have an ongoing bet about calling off our stacks with ace-king in a tournament, and neither of us has lost that prop bet after more than 2 years now, so that's a good piece of discipline we both had to learn the hard way. But I see this happening in cash games as well, and I can see a way that he can play that hand after you have four-bet it, but shoving makes absolutely no sense. Do you see this as often as I do?
I do. The thing that was, he had about $1,000 in front of him, $1,100. I don't remember exactly what it was. I've made it to 410. So now that's half his stack. Now, then he has an option. You know, if he thinks I'm doing this with queens or jacks, he can just smooth call me, see the three cards, and then if an ace or a king comes, then he makes his decision and shoves it in there.
Yep.
If it doesn't, then boom. The thing that you have to do when you're playing these, whether it's a tournament or cash or whatever, is put your opponent on a range of hands. What hands would I be playing there that either he's dominating, he's racing with, or he's losing to? Put him in the three different categories and decide what the most intelligent move would be.
Right.
Well, now, obviously, aces or kings, I'm going to be doing that with, and he's dominated. Queens or jacks, he's racing, if I would do that with a four-bet with the queens or jacks. Now, do I do that with any hand that he's dominating? Would I do that with an ace-queen suited? Would I do that with an ace-jack, with a king-queen, with any of those hands? In a cash game, highly unlikely. In a tournament, possible, actually. But in a cash game like this, I've only been at the table 15 minutes. This is only like the second hand, third hand I've played. I don't know. Your thoughts on it, Paul? Do you ever shove out there with an ace-jack suited four-betting somebody in a cash game?
I have, but it completely depends on who the opponent is in that situation. And remember, you didn't four-bet shoved. You four-bet raised. And then he 5-bet shoved with his ace-king, which is not a great play. Now, we have to differentiate between cash game play and tournament play, because it's entirely possible that if you're both short-stacked in a tournament, he wants to get it in with ace-king, and he may end up being dominated there. But you could certainly be also 4-betting him there with ace-queen if you're short-stacked, although it's probably more likely that if you're really short, you're going to be shoving with your 4-bet there. But still, maybe he's got a little bit more equity in a tournament than he would in a cash game. But in a cash game where you really do want to play for stacks, I think if he wants to continue to play that hand and not just sacrifice the $145 he put in when he when he 3-bet it pre-flop, you know, throwing it away is one option. Just say goodbye to that 145 and you move on to the next hand. Most people with ace-king aren't going to do that. The only other option, as far as I'm concerned, is to make that call, but it's very opponent-dependent. And again, you may have only been there for a few hands, but you have a reputation because people have seen you play. And maybe they think to yourself, he's a pro. He's going to try to push the table around a little bit. He's going to try to push me around a little bit. He doesn't know who I am. You know, ego gets involved in those sort of decisions. But again, the only play there, as far as I'm concerned, is to call. You never are shoving there, because what are you ever going to get called by? Yes, you might get a guy who is doing that with nines or tens or jacks or maybe even queens to lay it down, but what are you ever going to get called by? And if you are in a cash game, you should always be thinking, I'm playing for stacks. And the only way he's going to get your stack is if he calls your four bet and an ace or a king flops, and now he wants to get it all in. And if it turns out that you have aces or kings, well, then that's poker. But if you are actually doing that with the queens or even the jacks or making a move with something else, that's what he wants to do. He wants to get all of your chips. He doesn't want you out of the hand. That's how I would play it.
Yeah, and actually, if you look at the mathematics for it, when I made it 45, I got the two other callers. That's another $90 plus your 5-10 for the small and big blind. So there's another $100 outside of my money in there. When I make it the 410, and then if he shoves over it with only about 1,100 in front of it, well, I mean, it's only going to cost me another little under $600 to call him. And I've got, you know, well over 2-to-1 advantage there.
Yep.
I'm not going to lay down queens, jacks, tens there in that case. If I put 410 out there and all he has is 1,100, yeah, the money's going to go in if he forces me to do it.
Right. And the other side of it is, look at the math from his side of it. As you said, you're 45 plus the other two 45s, that's 135 plus the small blind and the big blind makes a total of 150, plus he put in 145. So there's almost $300 in the pot. You made it 410, so that's going to cost him another 265 to call. 265 with 410 in the pot. He's not really getting the right odds. Let's say you do have kings there, so his ace is his only live card.
Yeah.
That means he's a 30% favorite. It's 70-30 at that point if he only has the three outs for the aces. He's not getting the right odds there mathematically to make the move. However, when you do the implied odds of possibly getting the rest of your stack, then the move is right. I can see doing it in that way. I think many, many times I'm throwing that hand away when you're four-betting me, but there are going to be occasional times, again, depending on the opponent, where I'm going to make that call. Maybe I'm going to end up sacrificing the 410 if I miss the flop completely. Maybe I'm going to end up losing my whole stack if you do have aces or kings and an ace or a king flops. But I think it can, in the long run, be a profitable play, completely dependent on who you're playing against. If the rock at the table does that, there are going to be skid marks on my cards going into the muck pile. If it's the loosest player at the table who's doing that, and he ends up beating me, then that's okay, because now he's still going to have chips. And in a cash game, I can always reach in my pocket, and hopefully I've got enough of a bankroll that I can play another hand. Now, please tell me that this guy rebought in your circumstance.
No. He was gone from the table, unfortunately. So... But and there were some very, very good players down there. Don't get me wrong. But there were some people that really wanted to mix it up. They were down there. They were down there to have fun. Some of them probably had played quite successfully online, had a pretty good bankroll. And they were down there to mix it up. And other people at the table literally might have been four betting with an ace jack or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But not me.
Yeah.
Not in that situation. Not when I've only seen a few hands, not when I have never played against this guy a single hand till then.
All right. Well, speaking of the PCA, a couple of our former guests and former world champions from 2009 and 2010 both had a pretty good run down there. Joe Catta, who won the main event in 2009, won the $2,000 buy-in side event down there, took home $175,000. I think that's Joe's biggest take-home since the main event. So that's a nice piece of change for him. And Jonathan Duhamel, who won the main event in 2010. Wow, did this guy have a big PCA. He entered five events, and he cashed in four of them. He made the final table in four of them, including winning the $5,000 event. He came in second in the $25,000 event, and he came fourth in the Super High Roller $100,000 event. That's the one we talked about last week, where he actually rebought, and his $200,000 investment turned into $313,000. His total take-home from the PCA, $1.2 million. That's Eric Seidel-like January.
Close to it. He had a heck of a series down there. He played so well. We commented when he won the final table about how solid a player he was, and that has not changed. If anything, he's improved it a little bit.
Yep.
So nobody likes sitting down with him to your left. That's for sure.
Now, that's a pretty good comeback, considering a couple weeks earlier it was all bad news about him with the home invasion and his bracelet being stolen and a lot of cash and his ex-girlfriend being involved in all that. And there was also a story from down there about after he came in second in the 25K high roller, he was out partying with some friends, and some guy sucker punched him in a bar down there. So my advice for Jonathan would be maybe lay low for a couple of weeks. I mean, I don't know.
But if you've met Jonathan, he is so laid back and so friendly. Somebody sucker punching him? It doesn't even make sense to me.
A German player named Martin Finger apparently didn't like something somebody said or whatever it was. And, sucker punched him at some nightclub down there. So,
wow.
Yeah, but anyway, $1.2 million will soothe the bruise, I'm sure. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, live from Harrah's St. Louis World Series of Poker Room, and from Las Vegas as well. He's Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. A reminder, if you don't listen to our show live Tuesdays at 3 on KFNS, you can always listen to us on your smartphone. We're available via iTunes, for those of you who have iPhones or iPads. And we're now also available via Stitcher. You can download the Stitcher radio app. That's good on all smartphones, and you can listen to the show that way. A couple of other things to talk about here that don't have to do with the PCA. One has to do with here in Missouri. Missouri has something called the DAP program, the Disassociated Persons Program. And what this is something that they put out for people who have gambling problems, where you go to the state and you add your name to a list, and you essentially bar yourself from playing in any of the casinos in the state, not just here at Harrah's or any of the others in Missouri, but every one of the more than a dozen casinos across the state. It then becomes a crime for you to enter any of those casinos. If you're caught on the casino floor, I think it's a Class B misdemeanor, trespassing, something like that. The thing about this is that Missouri was one of only three states who had this disassociated persons program. And once you get on the list, you're on it for the rest of your life. And until recently, there was no way for you to get off that. So let's say you're 23, 24 years old, and you've been giving too much money away at the blackjack tables or the craps tables or the slot machines or the poker room or wherever it is, and you realize you have a problem and you want to get on the list. You get on that list, but you can never get off the list. Then, 20 years go by, and you're now a responsible adult, and you've got things under control, and you want to be able to come back in and maybe play a little bit of poker or sit down at a blackjack table or just come and have some friends sit down at some slot machines and have some fun. Well, you can't do that under the way the program has been. However, they have recently made a change. Effective on March 30th of this year, they are going to change it from a lifetime ban to a five-year ban. So anybody who has recently gotten on the list will have to apply after a five-year waiting period, and then the state might let them back in. And anybody who's been on the list more than 5 years, the same thing, they would have to apply. So, again, you got on when you were 24 years old, and now you're 34 years old. You've been on there for 10 years. You would apply to the state, and you would be able to perhaps get back in there. You apply to the Missouri Gaming Commission. I wrote to Leanne McCarthy at the MGC today to get exactly the information on this, and she said, yes, the rules changes will become effective March 30th. At that time, a form will be available so people can petition the MGC to remove their names from the list if they've been on it 5 years or longer. You fill it out, you send it back to us for processing, and we in turn send you back written confirmation that you're off the list. Once off the list, if you choose to come back on the list, that would be for life with no other chance of removal. So in other words, you had a problem, so you went on the list. Now you've been on for more than 5 years. You want to give it a shot, and you realize again, you know what, I do have a problem. Well, then that's your second chance, and you're not going to get a third chance. Leanne told me, quote, "We don't know yet what, if any, casinos will choose to allow those who've been on the list back into their facilities. We'll be hearing from the casinos within the next month or so." So Harrah's hasn't developed a policy yet. Some of the other casinos in the St. Louis area or in Kansas City or elsewhere in the state haven't developed policies yet. But for people who did put themselves on that list and may have thought to themselves it was a good idea at the time, but now I'm more mature and I can handle that, at least there's going to be a way back to some place if you want to come back and play poker or any of the other games inside the casino. I think that's a good change because it puts the power back in the hands of the person. What do you say?
I absolutely agree. It should be your own choice. You should be able to regulate it. I like that they have the option. If you feel you're powerless, that you can't control it, you can actually get yourself banned from there, but you still have your one option. At the end of the 5 years, you can give it a second try. You can do something that way. Hopefully that's something that no one will ever have to you know, partake in, shall we say. But any kind of what they call social conscious amendments or policies or regulations are usually out there for the betterment of the people. And if we can do it in such a way that it leaves a choice for the poker player, but he does have that option, yeah, I like that.
Here's the thing I like about it. I think they'll get more people on the list now. Because I think there were people who may have said, well, I have a problem, but I don't want to have a lifetime ban.
Yep.
If I can just stay away for 5 years, I think maybe by then I'll have my life together in whatever way it was or whatever financial problems I'm in now. You know, and you don't have to just come back at 5 years in one day. You can wait 7 years, 2 months, 11 years and a day, you know, whatever it is that you want to do. But to give you that choice, I think we'll get more people to say, you know what? I need to take a break from this. For whatever reason, maybe it's family pressure, maybe it's financial trouble, for whatever reason it is, I know several people who have gotten on this list, and you know what? They don't really quit. They end up playing in home games, or they get involved in other things that they want to do, because they kind of like the juiced up feeling that they get when they're playing. And they're going to find that outlet anyway. At least when you're doing it in a casino, you have A, social pressure, and B, a regulated atmosphere in which you know you've got cameras, you've got security people, you've got other people who are going to make sure that you're doing it in a safe way. And so I think that there will be more people who will apply for this when it's not a lifetime ban.
Well, I hope you're right. That's a good interpretation, and I hope people see it as that way. So, but I like putting the responsibility back to the people. I think it should be the people's choice on what they want to do,
now,
your own individual one.
While we're talking about this, we have a story from France about a poker player there who was suing the French government for 100,000 euros, claiming that the government failed to block him from accessing online poker sites. It's a 37-year-old guy who registered with the Interior Ministry last year to prevent him from going into casinos and logging into online gambling sites. But he says he was listed under the wrong address, so he was allowed to continue gambling online. The government says, you could have checked with us at any time to make sure that you're on that list. And all you had to do was, once you were able to access it, let us know and we would have fixed it. It's just an administrative error, and we don't feel like we're responsible for your losses at that point. And again, that comes back to the personal responsibility aspect of this.
Yep, 100% it does. And I'm sorry, I just don't have a whole lot of sympathy for him. If he got in online when he wasn't supposed to, you know, he should have had... It flabbergasted me that he would turn around and even try to sue him.
Yep.
I mean, this should be laughed out of the courtroom.
I agree.
I just don't agree with it whatsoever. It's just ludicrous.
All right.
It's worse than spilling hot coffee on your lap at McDonald's.
While we're talking legal stuff, you have a story about a lawsuit against Ultimate Bet. And there's a name we haven't really talked about much for many, many months. What's the story?
Well, it came out today. And again, this is just something that has hit the news. I saw it a couple of hours ago. It seems this is related back to the Russ Hamilton deal. There were, on January 13th, there were eight high-stake poker pros that filed a complaint. And what it was, it's alleging that all of the stuff that happened between 03 and 08, that the millions of dollars that were legally scammed from people by them cheating was never fully answered or taken care of by Ultimate Bet, that they didn't release hand histories, that they didn't release the names of the other accomplices with Russ Hamilton, that they didn't do a whole mess of different things. And they are suing them now for, I believe it's $20 million because of their failure to disclose, and they're assuming that because they didn't disclose, they were protecting, hiding, shielding either personal friends or people that actually owned or had shares in this company. And so they're going to try to get basically get the books opened up and find out who it was that profited and how much they profited and whether that money got rightfully returned or not. And, you know, it's opened up a whole can of worms. We'll see how far the complaint goes. But basically they're alleging that UB allowed others or did directly view plaintiffs hold cards during the high-stake matches that were being run there.
So they're saying that all of this was really put on Russ Hamilton when there are other people who are to blame, and since nobody's taken any action against them, they're going to try to use the courts to recoup some of their losses?
Yes, that's exactly what they're doing. And these are names that you know, if you play online, you probably heard of some of them. A Brad Booth or Dustin Wolf or Tom Correll. These are guys that play them in those bleed ones, and they're claiming that they lost, you know, individually hundreds of thousands and cumulatively millions because of this scandal that was never fully refunded to them. So I don't know. We will see how this goes, but it just did get filed here, or just made the news today, is I guess it was filed on the 13th. So unfortunately, that's another ugly episode of poker that we thought had buried, and now it's rearing its ugly head again.
While we're talking about online poker, I want to play for you a piece of audio from CNBC last week. James Murin, who is the CEO of MGM Resorts International, MGM Mirage, Bellagio, whatever the company name is. He's the CEO of the MGM Casino Empire. And he was on CNBC talking about online poker's chances of returning to the U.S. this year, a topic that we have touched on considerably over the course of the last 9 months since Black Friday, and which we have discussed at length in just our first two shows of this year. And we're going to continue covering it because we believe that the circumstances have changed. Let's play you just 2 minutes of that interview with James Murin on CNBC. Roll it, Jason.
Let's tackle the justice thing first. How much does this move the ball forward?
Well, it means that internet gaming is going to pass here in 2012 in the United States. The contours of the deal are unclear right now. We're not sure whether it'll be done at the federal level, which it should be done at, or on a state-by-state basis.
It's tougher when things are bifurcated or splintered the way states often handle law. They say it doesn't violate federal law if it doesn't involve sports betting. So what ostensibly could a scenario look like, and where do you think it would happen first?
Well, the scenario could look like, well, it will look like internet poker. It'll be limited to poker. And it should look like it at the federal level, because that's where we can best regulate, prevent fraud, prevent underage gambling, and get rid of the illegal gaming sites that still exist today with one uniform regulatory framework. If the federal government fails to act on that basis, I believe they will, by the way, but if they fail to act, state after state after state will approve internet poker, and it will proliferate on that basis, which will still create a big market. Certainly, we'll participate either way, but it'll be more on a patchwork basis and less clear.
Yeah. How well poised are you to pounce on that trend, and what could it mean for earnings down the road, for growth?
Well, it will be a multi-billion-dollar business. It already is, only it's being done in the shadows. It's being done illegally. Now it'll be done legally out in the public, and it will be a multi-billion-dollar business. we were in the on the leading edge of this. We formed a deal with BWIN Party Poker, the leader in the internet gaming space over in Europe. And we also have another site that we've been working on as well. With all the brands that we have between Bellagio and MGM, Mandalay and Mirage, combined with the technology that we have with BWIN, I imagine we'll be a very large market participant. It'll be hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue to us as a company, billions, as I said, to the industry, and it will happen this year.
That's James Murren, who's the CEO of MGM Resorts International on CNBC last week.
What I noticed there was the lack of any kind of hesitation or any kind of adjective. He didn't say should be or maybe or whatever. He flat out stated it. It will happen this year, period. It will be internet or online poker. Wow. I mean, I had not heard this before, but those are just flat out-and-out statement. No hesitation, no conditions or whatever. It's going to happen, according to him, period.
Now, do you think he's talking about Nevada, which we've talked about as being the state that will take the lead on this? Because he doesn't seem, it seemed to me like he was talking about the states taking the lead because the federal government won't do that. And he's all set up there in Nevada, as is Steve Wynn and certainly Caesars, the parent company of Harrah's, where we do our show. So they're all ready to go, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that is correct. I think he sees the federal government still dragging its feet a little bit, and then state by state by state as they get it approved, and the federal government will be forced to do something. That's the most likely scenario right now. But I really was caught by his statement, because they were just flat out, period, statements.
Yep.
No hesitation whatsoever. It will happen in 2012,
yep.
Period.
You're right. He wasn't saying I hope. He was saying it will.
Yeah.
All right. So let's take a break here, and then we'll come back, and we'll be joined by Matt Glantz, who's got $4 million in tournament winnings and a whole bunch of high-stakes cash games and mixed games that we're going to talk to him about, and also a great recent post on his blog about the responsibility poker players have to the game and to the industry. That when we continue with the Final Table Poker Radio Show live from Harrah's St. Louis World Series of Poker Room and from Las Vegas here on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. I am Paul Harrah's, sitting at the feature table of the World Series of Poker Room at Harrah's St. Louis. Dennis Phillips is in Las Vegas, and quick plug for this place here in St. Louis. Harrah's is having their World Series of Poker main event qualifiers. This weekend will be the first of the series, Saturday and Sunday, noon and 3. We've told you about these before. This is how Dennis got in to the main event in 08. You put up $200, you beat the 9 people at your table, you go to the final table, you beat those 9 people, boom. You're in the $10,000 main event at the World Series of Poker, and perhaps on your way to being a poker millionaire like Dennis. So this weekend, 4 chances, noon and 3, Saturday, noon and 3 on Sunday. And then next weekend, we will have Big Game 2. This is the $15,000 buy-in cash game. No limit hold'em, 25-50 blinds and $10 antes. It is going to go on here starting on Friday night, the 27th. We have people coming in once again from all over the Midwest to play in this game. We'll probably get a couple of tables of that game going, and also have parallel games going that'll be 10-20 no limit with a $5 ante and a minimum buy-in of $2,500. So if you're interested in being part of Big Game Weekend, we've got hotel room discount rates and information on the restaurants here, and we'll pick you up at the airport if you're coming in from out of town, and all the rest. You can email us at DennisPhillipsPoker@gmail.com. That's DennisPhillipsPoker@gmail.com. Or send us a message on Twitter. Dennis is Dennis_Phillips, and I am Paul Harrah's Show. We hope to see you here either for the qualifiers this weekend or for the big game next weekend, January 27th, 28th, and 29th. Now we roll along with the final table, and Dennis will introduce today's guest.
Well, it's kind of hard to know where to start with. You may have seen him. He was today's guest. He's on the cover of Card Player magazine a couple of months ago, just as part of that big year that he had last year in 2011. He made $500,000 in the WSOP. He had five different caches, including what is arguably the toughest field out there, the 50K Poker Players Champion, where he made the final table. He's already had two caches in the Epic Poker League, which, again, is, you know, just so deep with talent there. He's had three deep runs in WPT events. He actually won a deep stack event at the Borgata. He's definitely one of the most respected mixed games and high-stakes players in the world. In fact, he was down there at the PCA playing in the high-stakes room with other people that we've had here, Jean Robert and Elia Lazaro, and other people that we've had on the show before. Matt Glantz, welcome to the final table.
Hey, Dennis, how's it going?
Ah, that's good. Hey, how was your PCA, and tell us about that high-stakes cash game.
PCA for me wasn't so good. I played four or five tournaments and went 0-4. Didn't cash in any of them, which is a shock to the system for me. Over the last year, I've been pretty much cashing everything I've played. So it's a little bit of a rough patch that week, but everything's good. The cash games were good down there. There was a lot of 300, 600, and 400, 800 mixed games. With some of the guys you said, we had Bobby Boulan, we had Ellie Reza, Jason Mercier. We have a lot of big names, Eugene Katchelov playing the game. So, you know, a lot of guys that you're familiar with from the tournament circuit. It was fun.
What kind of games are you playing in those high-stakes cash games down there?
Down in the Bahamas, we were playing a mix of mostly draw games. The mix was dictated mostly by John Robert. He's like the leader of the pack as far as, you know, what he wants to play, everyone's going to be willing to play. So we were playing Badusi, Badesi, Badugi, Triple Draw, and, you know, a couple games that you're familiar, your listeners are familiar with, Studiator Better, Limit Hold'em, Oh My Low, but mostly the draw games because that's what Bobby wants to play now. That's what he feels like his biggest advantage is.
And when you say we play what Bobby wants to play, is that because you think of him as the guy who's going to contribute the most?
Well, I mean, it's a myth with Bobby. He's a much better player than people give him credit for. It's more of the fact that people just love to play with him. He's a great guy to play with. And when he organizes a game or he starts a game, he's going to play the mix he wants, and people are going to play with him.
But you've been pretty active in the field since about 04. I actually found an article that was printed in 09 where they listed the 20 greatest cash players in history. I mean, with Chip Reese, with Phil Ivey, you know, a whole mess of people. And you're listed on this thing in 09 with Barry Greenstein and the rest of them. Where did you cut your teeth? How did you get so good?
I mean, I don't know if I'm so good, but I've been doing it for a long time and you know, making a living at it. So I enjoy it a lot. I've been playing on the East Coast. You know, I live outside Philadelphia, so it's an hour and a half drive for me down to Atlantic City. And I'm playing in a mixed game, usually about 300, 600. Sometimes it gets a little bigger. But I guess the standard game is 300, 600 at Borgata. Beautiful place to play. And I'm there almost every week, and I'm not traveling for tournaments. And the rest of the week, I'm home with the kids doing the regular school stuff and after school things. So I'm really just playing mixed games as a priority for as far as poker goes, as far as poker for a living. The tournaments, for me, just started recently, like in the last year or two, I've started playing more tournaments. So that's why when you say cut your teeth, that's why, you know, people outside of poker don't really know me that well because I've played mostly cash games since I've started playing poker.
Now, I know on the East Coast, because I used to live there, and I didn't live close enough to get there in an hour and a half. I used to live in the Washington, D.C. area, so it was like a four-hour drive up to Atlantic City, and in those days there was no Borgata, so I used to play at the Taj. But I know that Stud was the game there and really is one of the few places there, and I guess Foxwoods are among the few places where Stud is a game that gets played on its own, not in mixed games, but people will sit down and they'll play 75, 150, or 150, 300 stud. Is that where you started out, working your way up the stud ladder?
I didn't really start playing poker until the Borgata opened. When I was playing poker as a hobby before the Borgata opened, I guess that was 10 years ago, just you know, once a month, maybe I would go down to the casino just to see what's going on, play 5, 10, limit hold'em or something. The stud was the big game. They had, I think, most weekends they had 300, 600 stud and maybe stud 8 or better, but mostly stud. And those guys that used to play in that game have kind of morphed into the horse game over at the Borgata now. So it took a few years once the Borgata opened, but that game moved over from the Taj You know, obviously the Borgata is a much nicer place to play poker. It's one of the nicest places in the country to play poker. So we have a great private new high limit room that just opened up last month, which makes it even better. And there's the game there every, like, usually Thursday to Sunday. And the games keep growing over there.
The first time that I had played against Matt was actually at the High Roller event in London in 2009.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Seventh in that, and you won it.
I won it even after a little hiccup by Dennis Phillips. I don't know if you remember the hand.
Oh, I do. Believe me, I sucked out major against him.
Okay, tell us. One of you has to tell us all what the hand was.
I don't know if Dennis remembers the bet size. I have no idea about the bet sizing or anything like that. It's been 2 or 3 years. But I do remember I was chip leader in the event with maybe, there might have been 20 or 30 players left, maybe 20 players left. And we got it all in pre-flop. I had two kings. He had two queens. I mean, it was a standard play. I would have done the same thing with Dennis's hand. But he actually didn't want to put the money in. He really didn't like his hand, the way the hand played out. We got it all in pre-flop. And he hit a queen, so I went from chip leader to maybe like bottom five in chips, and then I still went on to win that tournament. So whatever, it worked out to the best. You know, if I would have won that pot from you, Dennis, I might not have won the event. And that was a big first pot. I think that was my biggest score ever. That was about $800,000+ U.S. But that was the London EPT High Roller event.
And Dennis, if you hadn't caught the queen, you wouldn't have gone on to finish seventh. But he says that you were hesitant to put the money in. Do you remember that?
I absolutely do. Let me tell you, Matt has the respect of almost any player at the table, and I played with him for a little while. There's no way he was putting it out there without a premium hand. I just didn't have enough chips left. I couldn't lay it down. It was one of those old, please, please, please have ace king. And it didn't work out. So I do remember the hand. The other thing I was going to question, when we were down at the PCA, we were sitting around playing at Will the Thrill, a couple of other people there, and we started coming up with people. Will's question was this. If you had to pick five people that you were putting your own money in to back, who would you pick for that million-dollar challenge at Caesars this summer in the WSOP? And, Matt, your name came up with two or three of the different players. Are you going to be playing that one, or have you ever considered it?
I toss around the idea, but it's a huge buy-in, and even when I played the 100K down at the PCA, I sold a lot of pieces to friends, but which is pretty easy for them to sell 100K, but selling, you know, a piece of a million, you know, let's say I wanted to sell 800K out of the million, I think that would be kind of a long endeavor. I don't know if it's really worth it for me to even try to do that.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris in St. Louis. And Matt Glantz, our guest, is just outside of Philadelphia. Before we go on to a couple of other subjects here, I just want to go back to AC for a second, because I know that the casinos in Philadelphia have just opened up poker rooms in the last year or two. I'm curious what effect they have had on the AC poker action.
Well, it's a pretty noticeable impact. Borgata was basically the king of the East Coast up until the Philly poker rooms opened up. They lost a lot of their small limit business. Like when I say small limit, like 1-2 no limit, 2-5 no limit. They lost a lot of that business to Philadelphia only because of the proximity of the casinos in Philadelphia. Most of the people that played in Atlantic City came from New York or Philly. It's even closer for guys from New York to play in Philly, so those low-limit games, it's hard for them to track down there. But the high-limit games have stayed at Borgata, stayed in Atlantic City, so they're doing well in that area. That's their niche. It's more of a resort casino. The poker rooms in Philly don't really have hotel rooms attached. That's coming later, and things might change in a few years from now. But for right now, Borgata is the king of the high-limit, and the low-limit games are mostly at parks in Philadelphia.
Interesting.
I want, before we run out of time, I want to get to an article that you recently published that I just thought was phenomenal. And I don't want to get into too much detail. I would much rather hear it from you. But you brought up so many things there that hit home with me. You talked about players bringing chips down, like to the PCA. And then I don't know how many different times I've had to cash it for chips for people down there who didn't have the cash, or borrowing the money. And can you explain what the guts of the article was and why you wrote it?
The depth of the article was basically I was talking to the younger generation of professional poker players, the ones that you see on TV, the ones that are going to be the future of poker, and let them know that, you know, even though they're at the, you know, the top of the food chain in poker and they're having a great time, making a lot of money, that there's some responsibility they bear as far as the growth of the game. And I want them to realize that their actions are far-reaching when they're going to be on TV or interviewed for the media or through social media, all that kind of stuff. When these guys are out there, when they make a mistake publicly, it hurts us all. When they do good things for poker and promote poker in a positive light, it's really going to help the game. So I really want them to realize that that's a responsibility they have.
I want to read one of the paragraphs from this piece called Responsibility in Poker, because I don't want us to glaze over this, because it's a topic that Dennis and I have talked about on the show several times before. So here's one paragraph from what Matt wrote. Your actions at a poker tournament reflect on the entire industry. When you bust from a poker tournament through a bad beat and you decide to kick your chair, people notice. When they see you acting out like this, it makes it seem acceptable. When you tweet about the tournament director being an idiot without first confronting him with a specific issue, it benefits nobody. All it does is create resentment and further distances the players from the staff. When you berate a dealer or a floor person for making mistakes, in the eyes of those watching, it makes it the thing to do. Then the next day, when you're not around, you perhaps have influenced three young kids from your previous day's table who are just waiting for dealers or a floor person to slip up so they can berate them because they think it's cool. Now, you don't write that unless you've seen it. My question is, are you seeing it more now than you did several years ago?
No, I'm actually seeing it less and less now, especially the last 6 months or so since the Epic Poker League formed. I think the guys are getting more of a clue what's going on and seeing that, you know, their actions are far-reaching. There's a lot of great minds in poker. The young people I'm talking about, the guys in their 20s, there's a lot of great minds that could do a lot of things, but they're in poker. They're winning a lot of money their first few years out of school, or some of them dropped out of school to play poker, and they're doing really well. And I was there when I was a young guy out of college. I was on the stock exchange board doing well in a very similar kind of business. And I know where they're coming from. They feel like, you know, they're on the top of the world and nothing can hurt them. But they have to realize that, you know, the responsibility they bear to grow this game is, if they want to stay in poker for the long term, if they're going to regret their actions, anything they do now will be, you know, never forgotten on social media and, you know, never erased. So it's not like it was years ago. When these guys do things now, they really got to be careful. So I'm just trying to get them on the right path. You know, I'm friends with a lot of these young guys. There's so many good guys. You hear bad stories all the time, but I'll tell you what, the new young crop of poker players, you know, the top of the food chain, are really good guys. I mean, I can list a bunch of guys for you that are going to be leading poker in the future, and I can tell you one for one, each one of these guys is great guys. You can think about Jason Mercier or Eugene Katchelov, Sean Buchanan, Sam Stein, Mike McDonald. He's a real special. He's a kid, a genius. On the poker table and away from the poker table. There's guys like Doc Sands and Chris Klodnicki, who just won the last Epic tournament. There's a lot of guys like this that you can't overlook. They're going to be the ones that everyone's focused on from a media perspective.
Okay, so on the Epic Poker League, they put that Standard and Conduct Committee, which some people have been questioning, you know, with the Chino Reams and the rest of the thing. Is that a good thing to have within the league? Should some of the other people, maybe some of these other leagues, copy that or come out with it? Or do you see it as kind of an hinging on the players?
Well, not only is it a good thing for the league, Dennis, it's a great thing for poker. It's a much-needed board for the game of poker. There's no other kind of game or sport that's publicly on TV and other forms of media that doesn't have a standards and conduct type of committee. I wasn't on the committee when it originated in the summer. You know, they made those decisions about Chino and another decision where I was with you, Dennis. You know, I wasn't on the committee when they had those decisions made, but when I voiced my concerns to Annie Duke, who's the commissioner of that league, to her credit, she was willing to put me on the committee, even though she knew I was going to try to steer the committee on a different direction. And hopefully we're going to start doing good things. And I think it's a great group on that committee, and hopefully it'll expand outside the Epic Poker League to the rest of poker.
So you're on the Epic Poker League now, and the decisions we're talking about, for those of you who didn't hear us talking about it on the show last fall, was Chino Ream won,
one of the first Epic Poker League events, and because he owed money all over the place, the league decided to take disciplinary action against him and kind of put him on probation. Do you know, since you're a member of the committee, if there's been any follow-up with Chino to see what his status is now?
I think the follow-up will just be other members of the league making complaints against him if there's any kind of situations that arise. But really, I didn't like that decision. I don't think they should get involved in private issues between players. I think it should be the committee should be involved in public issues and more substantial issues than just private owing money to other players.
And what about the other incident involving a guy named Michael DeVita, who won a pro-am, which would have given him a $1,500 or $1,600 seat into one of the main events, or maybe he paid $1,500 and won a $20,000 seat. I think
right.
That's what it was. And then it turned out he had a kind of a dicey criminal record, and so they told him he couldn't play in the main event, and essentially they told him he could have his money back for the buy-in, but not for the $20,000 prize. What did you think of that one, and were you involved in that at that time?
I wasn't on the committee yet, and like you, I had a misconception that that was a committee decision. That wasn't a standards and conduct committee decision. That was a league decision. It wasn't in the hands of the committee. So it's a separate issue. If you have a problem with their decision, it's a league decision and not the ethics committee. But like you said, it was very concerning, and I voiced my opinion, and they're dealing with that now, and hopefully it works out.
Okay.
Now do you see why I like Matt, Paul?
Yeah.
I tell you, we're going to post this article on the webpage. I encourage everybody to read it. I think it's got some real gems inside of it. I really, really appreciate you writing it, and it sounds like you wrote it from the heart. And you have poker at your the well-being of poker as your major interest there, and I love that.
Yes. For sure, sir. I give my website so they can look at what you're talking about. The article is listed. It's on mattglanzpoker.com. It's MATTGLANTZ poker.com.
Yep. One other thing I just want to say about this, we're not just talking about a young generation of poker pros who sometimes are at fault here and need to keep an eye on that. It also happens even in low-stakes cash games, guys who are playing 1-2 or 2-5 or maybe up to 5-10, where somebody comes in who's just a complete recreational player. And Dennis, you and I have talked about this so many times, both on the air and off. A guy comes in, he just wants to have some fun. He's got a couple of $100s. He decided to give it a try in the poker room. He's going to have a couple of beers. He's going to hang out with his friends. He's going to play. And he gets involved in a hand where he sucks out on somebody and hits a two-outer. And now he's going to get berated at the table by somebody who may be a local grinder or maybe somebody else at the table who just goes after him. And when you do that, you end up destroying the game of poker from the bottom, which is the only place you can grow the game of poker. You need to have people coming in and playing at the recreational level and at those stakes in order to get themselves up to the kind of levels that Matt Glantz is playing at. If you do that to them early and they don't want to come back and they don't want to play, you're going to hurt the game. Not only that, why would you ever tell another player that he's not playing well when there's cash on the table?
You make a great point.
Well, we've all gone through it. We've all seen those other players. Hopefully, there's something for almost everybody in that article. Be you a young gun that's just won his first $1 million prize, or the grinder that's sitting at a 1-2 table. There's some pearls that can be gathered from that article. So I really, really encourage everyone to read it. Again, thanks, Matt, for writing it. I do like that. Quick question for you. Let's get off on a high note or something. Where are you going to next? You're going to the Aussie Millions or?
No, I don't travel. I went to Europe once in my life for poker. I've never gone to Australia. All my friends are heading there again. It's just too much of a trip for me. I got small children and a wife at home, which I really, really don't enjoy being away from. I'm not going to be traveling anytime in the next month or so, just the Borgata on weekends, and I'll play. There's a Borgata, $3,500, 2-day ones kind of event at the end of the month, so that's a big event. They usually get 700 or 800 players for that event. And I might fly down to Florida for the Hard Rock in the middle of February, but that's about it for the next 2 months.
Well, Matt, we really appreciate you taking the time to join us here today. I'm sure we'll run into you at some point this summer when we're all out at the World Series of Poker. You had a great year there last year, and in fact, all of last year was pretty darn good for you. And we really appreciate your time here today on the Final Table.
Thanks a lot, Paul, and thanks a lot, Dennis. Great talking to you guys.
All right, take care.
That's Matt Glantz joining us here on the Final Table Poker Radio Show. As we wrap things up here, Dennis, a reminder to our listeners to check out the Bravo Poker Live app to find out what's going on here at Harrah's St. Louis. That's where you can see all the games. One of the games that's not listed right now but will be in about 5 minutes is the PLO game, which we're about to start up at this very table. This is one of the centers of PLO, goes every day here in addition to lots of No Limit and even some high-low Omaha going on a regular basis. This weekend, the WSOP main event qualifiers. Next weekend, the big game. Now, where are you off to, Dennis?
I'm heading down to Oklahoma. I'm going to play in the circuit event down there with a couple of friends of ours, Jimmy Summerfield, and Kenny Lambert is running the event. They've had some record turnouts. They had over 1,000 in one of their events already. They had 808 last year in the main event. They expect over 1,000 this year. And just so I can get you, see if you can wet your whistle a little bit there, if I can talk, yeah, they're setting records in the cash game for their drop for the last week. Kenny said it's just going nuts upstairs in their poker room. So, you know, it's a great casino, well run with Jimmy Summerfield and his group, one of the last ones he's going to be doing. Kenny Lambert's well known in the poker world, running the room down there. The event's going to have over 1,000 people in the main, and hopefully I'll get to play 2 or 3 days.
Well, good luck there. I'm sorry I can't join you. Unfortunately, I had a conflict because I'm headed out to Commerce this weekend out in California where Matt Savage is starting up the L.A. Poker Classic, and I'm going to get involved in some of the cash game action there during some of their early rounds. So we'll talk about all of that when we regroup here next Tuesday at 3 for another Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips. I'm Paul Harris. Hear us live on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com, or via iTunes, or for all other smartphones. You can get us on Stitcher Radio or just listen to our podcast on Dennis's website, thechipleader.com.